A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 188. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking Not the First Doctor. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, indeed, Not the First Doctor, as we look at three non-canonical versions of the first ever Doctor Who. That's two movie versions of First Doctor serials. These are the Peter Cushing films, Doctor Who and the Daleks from 1965, and the sequel, Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD, which came out in 1966.
And just to keep things varied, we will also look at An Adventure in Space and Time, which was a BBC drama, or docudrama, if you like, about the original creation of Doctor Who. And it first aired in 2013, quite recently. And it focuses on David Bradley's portrayal of William Hartnell, who, of course, played the first Doctor. And each one of these three productions is about 80 or 90 minutes long.
Okay, and regular listeners will probably know that although our remit is British television science fiction, once a year we stray off topic slightly to look at a spin-off from a television show into another medium. So here we have, I think, our first ever actual cinematic movie spin-offs, Brian, that we've looked at in detail.
Yes, I think that's right.
So, you know, it's a couple of interesting films with Peter Cushing to talk about. As I say, our first TV movies, or our first movies from TV.
And An Adventure in Space and Time was something that was requested by our listeners on our Facebook group. Shortly after it broadcast, only months ago as we record, people were interested in hearing us talk about it, which, of course, is great to hear suggestions like that, and it's nice to be able to follow up on it.
Yep, so here we are talking about one of the most recent shows that we've covered. As you say, it's only months ago that this came out. And we'll get to that mostly in our episode 2, but lots of stuff to get through. And of course, if you have any other ideas for spin-offs that you'd like to hear us talk about, we'd be delighted to get your suggestions. We'll have our contact details at the end of this episode. Do let us know.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll start off with Doctor Who and the Daleks, which went into theaters in 1965, and it was based on the 1963-64 serial, The Daleks, which was the second Doctor Who serial, and it had lots of publicity and trailers in the Radio Times and so on. And this was really all around the fact that it introduced the Daleks, which made Doctor Who the phenomenon that was popular and was what it was. And it was based around that in about 1964. And it brought England into what was referred to as Dalek Mania, which was like a boom in merchandising and everything that was related to Daleks.
That's right, yes, because when the BBC were bringing back the Daleks to the television Doctor Who, as you say, Brian, Britain was gripped with Dalek mania. They were everywhere, and inevitably, perhaps, there was talk of a film version. And sure enough, the BBC were approached by three producers who wanted to make a Doctor Who movie. They were Milton Subotsky, Max Rosenberg, and Joe Vigoda, who had formed a production company called Amicus, which we'll talk about a bit. They were sort of rivals of Hammer. They were best known at the time for their portmanteau horror film Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which came out in 64 and also starred Peter Cushing. And they would go on later on to make other sort of portmanteau horror films. But at the time, that's what they were best known for.
Yes, horror films in Britain were sort of being really established as a genre in a big way around this time and for several years earlier. And Peter Cushing was definitely a big name in that genre by this point. So they bought the rights to make this Doctor Who Dalek film for £500, which is interesting to see that now.
Bargain.
Yes. And they agreed that the first film they were going to do would be an adaptation of Terry Nation's original serial, which was just called The Daleks. And the budget for that was going to be £180,000, which again, from today's perspective, seems like a pretty good deal, but it was significant at the time. And Sabotsky himself did the adaptation, scripted it, and actually worked on that with David Whittaker, who was the script editor on the original BBC serial. So he brought things into line to help things work a little bit better and feel a bit more like Doctor Who. And Amicus came up with this new production company and a new name to work on, and that was Aru, possibly to distance themselves a little bit from their horror films that Amicus was known for. Because, of course, this was really going to be a film that was geared towards children. It was focused much more on a younger audience than that original serial had been.
Yes, that's right. They really wanted this film to have a U for Universal certificate, as it was known back in the 60s, because as you say, Brian, they had to get the children and their families coming to see this film if it was going to be successful. So yes, they distanced themselves slightly from their horror production arm, and they also went so far as to submit the script before filming started. They sent the script to the British Board of Film Classification, basically to the censors, and the BBFC made a few changes and suggestions to ensure they would get their U certificate. So it was interesting. They were, you know, it was clearly part of the marketing drive and some clever thinking up front by Amicus and the producers.
Yes, they definitely had a different sort of focus and approach than the TV series did.
So we mentioned who did the scripting. The direction was interesting because there was a late change in directors. Freddie Francis was to direct. He'd done the earlier film, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which we'd mentioned, and would, of course, go on to very famously do the very sort of moody black and white cinematography on David Lynch's The Elephant Man in the late 70s. Although we've also mentioned him, I think, Brian, because he directed 5 episodes of Star Maidens, an interesting serial that we talked about last year.
Oh, yes.
But strangely enough, and for no really well-documented reason, Freddie Francis was taken off the production, or he left the production shortly before filming started. And so he was replaced by a director called Gordon Fleming, who would helm this first film and, in fact, go on to helm the second one as well.
Yes, that's right. Gordon Fleming was actually the father of Jason Fleming, who is a well-known actor now and has played Quatermass, among other things.
Oh, interesting.
So for the cast, the BBC Doctor Who regulars were making about 42 to 48 episodes of Doctor Who a year. They were really running full tilt and had to sort of squeeze in breaks for vacations for the actors. So using the original BBC cast was really not going to be an option for them. And Sabotsky also wanted an actor who was known in the US, which made Peter Cushing something of an obvious choice. He was already working at Shepperton Studios on The Skull, which was the next film that Amicus was working on. And they brought in, to round out that cast, they brought in Roy Castle as Ian, Jenny Linden as Barbara, Roberta Tovey as Susan, and Barry Ingham as Aladdin.
So there's the principal cast. We've mentioned the adaptation. And of course, you probably know, are very familiar with this, that the film makes certain well-known changes to the original sort of concept of Doctor Who. So here we have Doctor who is not a Time Lord. He's a kindly British scientist who has invented his own time and space machine, which is just referred to as TARDIS throughout. Inside, of course, it has a very different design to the one that we're familiar with from the TV series. Although on the outside, it still looks like the big blue police box, although I don't think that's ever explained why in either of the films. We just accept that's what the TARDIS looks like, or a TARDIS looks like. So there are sort of well-known, I think, changes here, Brian.
Yes, that's right. They kept the police box exterior, but the interior is different and the sound is different as well. It's strange, and one of the few places you have the image of the TARDIS and the TARDIS dematerializing, but you don't have the characteristic sound that's well known. And they also changed the relationships between the characters quite a bit. So Barbara and Susan are both the Doctor's granddaughters, or maybe I should say Doctor Who's granddaughters, because he is referred to consistently as Doctor Who in this. Ian is Barbara's boyfriend who accidentally sets the machine TARDIS running. And they made the supporting characters quite a bit younger, with Susan being very young indeed, and Barbara and Ian also being sort of somewhat younger than they were as teachers in the television versions. The Daleks themselves also had a slightly different look. Of course, they were in color. This was the first time that we had a version of Doctor Who in color rather than the black and white television broadcasts. And the Daleks were somewhat bigger and had vivid colors. They had, instead of the sucker arm that is sometimes called a plunger, some of them had more like a claw, and it sort of changed the look of things.
They also changed the Daleks' weapon, I believe. So they had this sort of smoke effect when they fired their guns, which was meant to make it look slightly less threatening for children. Again, aiming for that universal certificate. So they didn't have the sort of TV effect where they would reverse the sort of screenshot and go into a negative whenever the Daleks fired.
Yes, that's right. And the Dalek City and the makeup for the Thals, you know, all of it was sort of changed. And part of this was because they were producing this in Technicolor and Techniscope widescreen. So it was a different sort of approach than you would have with the television productions of the time.
Yes, absolutely. As well as very colorful Daleks, we get extremely colorful Thals with the sort of wigs and eye makeup that we'd perhaps later associate with Gerry Anderson's UFO and those strange ladies who operated the moon base.
Yes, that's right. It does have a very colourful look to it in places.
And this film was released, as we've said, 1965. Huge publicity campaign going with it. They even took the Daleks to the Cannes Film Festival itself, which I believe must be the only time that Daleks have ever invaded Cannes. And, of course, with the launch of the film, there was all the tie-in merchandise. So there was toys. We know there was games. We know that Century 21 comic had its own special edition for the Daleks. Lots of stuff at the time, and ways that, you know, children could buy their Daleks, all to tie in with this big budget, big colourful release on the screen.
Yes, and this was all fitting in with Dalek mania, and it was as much about the Daleks as it was about Doctor Who in general. And in fact, the film was a critical success and a commercial success. It did quite well.
But it's so big in here, and yet it's so small from outside. How come? In electrokinetic theory, space expands to accommodate the time necessary to encompass its dimension.
My little fellow scientist, we've been working on TARDIS for many years. This is the final component. You are privileged, young man, to be the first visitor to our time and space machine. There. I can now set the controls for anywhere in time and space that we wish to go. When I push that lever, this room and everything...
Yeah, it did actually, I think, achieve their targets, so it made lots of money, and I suppose, inevitably, Subotsky and the other producers started immediately thinking of what would come next.
Yes, that's right, and it was only about a year later, in 1966, Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD came out on the big screen. And it was based on the Daleks Invasion of Earth, which was the second Dalek serial with the First Doctor, which broadcast in 1964. And again, Subotsky and Whittaker adapted Terry Nation's script. Gordon Fleming was directing once again. And Roberta Tovey came back as Susan, along with, of course, Peter Cushing as Doctor Who. Roy Castle and Jenny Linden were not available, so they did not reprise their roles.
That's right. Instead, we had two new characters. Jill Curzon played Doctor Who's niece Louise without too much explanation. She's just there as part of the TARDIS crew. And she's there when a police constable, Tom Campbell, who's attempting to foil a jewellery robbery and goes to seek help from what he believes is a real police box and stumbles in to the TARDIS, and they're away on their next adventure. And of course, Tom Campbell, famously played by that great British actor Bernard Cribbins, who we now think of as Donna Noble's grandfather, Wilf. But here he is back in 1966 in his first appearance in the Doctor Who universe, and turns in a pretty good sort of action hero type performance throughout the film, I think, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. It was good stuff. There was a pretty good cast on that one, I think. And again, they made some changes for the original. Of course, it was edited for a shorter running time. And quite clearly, they had to take out Susan's romance. In the original serial, Susan, the Doctor's granddaughter, falls in love with a character called David over the course of the story, which takes place over quite a while. And by the end of the story, Susan stays and does not leave with the Doctor. And that's how Carol Ann Ford's character, Susan, leaves the TV series. But that certainly wasn't going to happen with a 13-year-old Susan as played by Roberta Tovey. So that was... So that romance, of course, was not included. And they also added these framing scenes at the beginning and the end with Tom and the jewelry robbery situation.
Okay, we know they had a larger budget, this time £286,000, so an increase of £100,000 in a year, basically, because of the success of the first film. And they spent that on quite large sets, on 9 new Daleks, plus their flying saucer. You may remember the flying saucer sequence from the original TV serial. And of course, here it's done slightly bigger and better with a film special effects budget. So the matte paintings and the models perhaps slightly better than what we've seen before. But we have to say that we know that this was a slightly troubled production. There were a few problems. There's a famous sequence which is included in the film where a stuntman has an accident and actually broke his ankle, I believe. And also, there was a rather major problem for them, which was that Peter Cushing was ill during the production. And in much the same way as the television series often had to do with William Hartnell, I think they had to do some quick rewrites. And I suspect that there are body doubles in long shots in various scenes in order to cope with Cushing's absence, because the production had a fairly, I think, tight window and they were pressing ahead. So, and even in the original TV serial, I think Hartnell himself had had an accident and had to miss one episode. So there's some strange parallels there, Brian.
Yes, very odd indeed. And there was a pretty big publicity campaign again with this film.
That's right. Yes, absolutely. They went to town advertising another Daleks film. And most notably, I think, is this rather strange tie-in with the breakfast cereal Sugar Puffs, where they'd obviously received an upfront consideration from Sugar Puffs, so much so that you will see Sugar Puffs posters at various times on walls of the ruined London, and also boxes of the cereal in various places and when they're actually food around. So you can't really help but notice that, first of all, great colourful Daleks, a huge spaceship, and then Sugar Puffs advertising everywhere.
A fine example of early product placement, right?
Yes, it must be one of the earliest examples there, Brian.
Now, unfortunately, even with all this, the critical reaction and the commercial results were not as strong as the first film. Possibly because it was something they had seen before by that point, but there are also other potential reasons there.
Yes, there is one possible theory why the second film wasn't a success, and I'm indebted to a rather interesting book by Charles Norton called Now on the Big Screen, which documents all the various attempts to bring Doctor Who to the big screen over the years, not just the two Peter Cushing films we're talking about here. But in his book, he mentions that, well, there was something new happening in 1966. The Adam West Batman serial had just started to air, both in America and quickly afterwards in Britain. And Dalek Mania had perhaps been replaced by Batmania.
That's quite possible. It is true that if you look at the Dalek products that were out there and all of these Dalek Mania references, they were sort of 1964, 65, much less so by the time you get to 66.
So maybe a change in popular culture, and as a result, the second film, not quite the commercial success they wanted compared with the first one. And, of course, Amicus had ideas about making a third Daleks movie, I think, Brian, but, of course, that never happened.
Yes, there was a plan to do a third movie that would be based on the script of The Chase, which was the third Dalek serial on the TV series. And of course, after the performance of Dalek Invasion of Earth 2150 AD, that did not happen. Could have been interesting. Something else that's worth noting in the sequence of things is that when Dalek's Invasion Earth 2150 AD came out in 1966, William Hartnell was still the Doctor. It was still the first Doctor on TV, but it was not much later. It was within a couple of months that Patrick Troughton took over and you had a completely new era, and it was no longer that William Hartnell is the Doctor and that was the only idea of who the Doctor should be, and then the film version was sort of based on that. You now had the concept of there being different Doctors that could be very different in personality, and that sort of changed everything and may have had some impact on how the film performed, but also I think might have had some impact to the idea of continuing on with the films with Peter Cushing.
Okay, so just the two Peter Cushing films that we've been talking about. And of course, we should talk about availability and whether or not you want to add these to your collection if you've not already got them. So here in Region 2, both of the films were released on DVD. And in fact, there was a box set, which is still available, of both films. It includes a documentary about the whole concept of Dalek Mania and the phenomenon of that during the 60s. Currently, that box set of both films on Amazon is about £22, although you may pick it up cheaper on the marketplace. But also, quite recently, we've had both films released on Blu-ray, and that's what I've been watching. They are about £15 for each one. And again, you get lots of extras. You get that documentary about Dalek Mania is on the first film, but there are making of features. There's interviews with some of the actors. Bernard Cribbins, I know, is on the second disc. So lots of stuff on there. We'll also next time be talking about An Adventure in Space and Time. So while we're on the subject of DVDs, here in Region 2, that's available, plus several extras about the making of the programme. And that's about the same price, currently £16 on Amazon, but again, you may find it cheaper. And all three of them, the two Cushing films and the BBC show, are currently available on iTunes to buy or to rent. So there are plenty of ways to get hold of them here in Region 2. Over in Region 1?
Over here in Region 1, there are also ways to get all of these. The Dalek films are available on a DVD box set that sells for about $20, and also available to buy or rent on Amazon Instant for, I think, $3 or $7 for the two. So there are some things available. There is no Blu-ray release for Region A, but there have, I believe, been multiple DVD releases in both Region 1 and Region 2, actually. An Adventure in Space and Time, the DVD release, came out and then disappeared very quickly. It is already out of print and a little bit expensive, but there is a Blu-ray DVD combo pack that includes An Adventure in Space and Time with the extras on a Blu-ray disc and on a DVD disc, and there is a third disc that includes An Unearthly Child, which is the first Doctor Who serial from 1963. So that's a very nice package. It goes for about $18 on Amazon in the US and $22 on Amazon in Canada. There is also some availability for it on iTunes and Amazon Instant. Both of those services had Doctor Who 50th anniversary packages that included Doctor Who episodes and some extra content, and also included An Adventure in Space and Time. So there is lots of availability for all three of these productions in multiple regions.
Splendid. Lots of ways to get hold of it to watch and enjoy these rather remarkable productions that we're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. So that about wraps things up for the first half of this discussion. Next time, we will, of course, discuss An Adventure in Space and Time, as promised.
And we'll be doing our reviews and try and perhaps put these three productions in order of our favourites and give you some advice about whether you should be adding them to your collection and which one in particular is the most essential purchase.
Yes, absolutely. You can find us at BritishInvaders.com, and we are part of the Geek Culture Network, so you can find us at TheGeekCultureNetwork.com. We also have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us that way as well.
And you may also find us at the Voice of Geek streaming radio network at VogNetwork.com, where we are one of several geek-related shows that go out on a regular basis. You'll find us there on Mondays and Tuesdays, but come along and find out what other good shows you can get through Vogue Network.
Yes, there's a nice active community there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and until next time, it's Eamon in England also signing off.